from my office who will then introduce the other panelists of the third panel. This panel deals with the 2011 OVDI. This is the information that perhaps everybody came to hear about. And Matthew?
Thank you, Morris.
Hey everybody, as Morris said, my name is Matthew Morris, and I'm an attorney at M. Robinson & Company, tax associate. And I'm going to be talking about, you know, some general information about the 2011 Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Initiative and some of my professional experience working in this program. So first thing I want to talk about is pre-clearance. And basically, once your client has decided that he or she wants to participate in the 2011 OVDI, you've got to file a pre-clearance letter. And as Bill Lovett talked about earlier today, you know, the importance of this letter is to basically get certification from the IRS that no criminal investigation has been initiated against you, and that you're, you know, you're cleared for participation in the program. There's actually a fax number here that you can use. It's an office in Philadelphia. It's sort of the central office that takes all of the pre-clearance requests, and they just run a quick check of the Social Security number in their database, see if there's any investigation pending. If there's not, the pre-clearance, you know, approval will go out fairly soon after sending the initial letter. And Attorney Lovett's already spoken about pre-clearance with the Department of Justice. Remember, there are two separate pre-clearance processes. Okay, so here's a situation we haven't encountered, but it's possible we could encounter it, is if the IRS refuses pre-clearance, which means that, you know, there's already an investigation pending against, you know, your client or your potential client. You have a range of options here. You can do nothing, or you could. Now, do nothing does not mean that you can, as a tax return preparer, prepare tax returns that do not list the foreign income. That is just not a choice under ethical rules, under Circular 230. It's also a violation, so that's not an option. But there is a possibility of sort of not doing anything and waiting until the investigation begins and then providing information, you know, as it becomes available. The other option is to basically treat it like the taxpayer has been admitted to the program, meaning you gather all the information from the foreign banks, you know, prepare all the FBARs, prepare the amended tax returns, and submit everything to the IRS as if he or she were already admitted. The danger in doing that is in a criminal case, anything that is put in a tax return can be considered an admission. So you have to be very careful about what information you're presenting or the taxpayer is presenting in that tax return. Okay, so that's a situation, like I said, we haven't encountered if they're rejected from preclearance. Typically, I would say a client will be eligible to participate. Like I said, the you know, the first sort of criteria is that there's no investigation, civil examination, or criminal investigation underway. So if a client is under audit, that's not gonna fly for participation in the 2011 program. And the other piece to emphasize is that someone raised a point earlier, if there were just previous years of FBARs that haven't been filed, but no income tax non-compliance, is that a situation where you'd come forward in the OVDI? And it's really not. If it's a situation where there's no tax owed and there's really just you know, a reporting requirement for the FBARs, you know, you would want to file the FBARs, and if necessary, file the amended returns, maybe just listing, I don't know, I guess you would just basically list the, you know, I'm not sure. It doesn't really make sense to me if the income wasn't subject to tax. I don't know how you'd report that. on a tax insurance. Well, perhaps if there's a foreign tax credit involved, that's a situation in which you'd want to attach a rider and explain that there's no additional tax due because of the foreign tax credit. So that's the basic eligibility. So remember, if you do not have any income tax non-compliance, it's really not a situation where you're going to be coming forward under the OVDI. So this is a question we get asked all the time. We have potential clients who are calling, and they want to know, you know, why they should participate. And I think the first thing that really can't be emphasized enough is peace of mind. We have a lot of clients who don't necessarily want to play games. They don't know what their exposure is. They don't know if you know, there is a possibility of criminal prosecution or not. And you know, it's difficult to tell. When you have a client who has a certain amount of undisclosed income from foreign accounts, it's not always clear that there's no intent to, you know, defraud or no intent to you know, to evade tax responsibilities. In that kind of situation, the peace of mind of participating in the OVDI, coming forward, providing all the information is very valuable, even if it would lead to higher penalties than a, you know, a quiet disclosure would, which is really just filing the FBARs and amended returns. Predictable results. It's uncertain in a, you know, civil audit if a client is going to go through the, you know, if going to be audited or exposed to a full-blown audit. It's difficult to tell what the exposure is going to be. There's, you know, as Tim's going to talk about later, there's a civil fraud penalty that might apply. You know, there could be reasonable cause, but maybe not. There's a lot of variables. But in the OVDI, it's a relatively predictable set of penalties. You're basically going to, the penalties are going to be applied very mechanically to the highest aggregate balance in your account, and you're going to know where you stand. The other possibility is that could be lower legal or professional fees in the OVDI than in a full-scale audit, which means that, again, we're not talking about quiet disclosure versus OVDI. We're talking about quiet disclosure added to, you know, the possibility of a full-blown audit as compared to participation in the OVDI. If a client comes forward in the OVDI, it's, you know, if the lawyer has experience in dealing with these cases, we can, you know, we're very efficient in handling them, and the legal and professional fees could be lower than in a full-scale audit. All right, what are the disincentives? Why do people not want to participate? You know, the first thing is really just the high penalty structure. I mean, it's, like I said, it's very mechanically applied. You've got a 25% penalty for accounts, you know, over $75,000, you know, the aggregate of all the accounts over $75,000. You know, it's a very high penalty. There's really no room to abate, or, you know, there's no reasonable cause for abatement of the miscellaneous penalty. So it's very rigid and harsh penalty structure. It's also difficult to participate without legal representation. You know, if a client comes forward and wants to participate in the OVDI, there's, you know, letters that have to be filed. You have to get into, you know, a calculation of the penalty structure. You've got to, there's a lot of steps to take that are very difficult without legal representation. Okay, so what do you have to do? What are the participation requirements? First thing after preclearance is that you've got to fill out a three-page letter. Morris has referred to it as a three-page letter, or it's called an optional format letter. And it's provided on the IRS website. And it just basically provides basic information about when the accounts were open, when they were closed, what is the source of funds in the account, and, you know, listing just basic information about the high balances for each year. So that's really the first thing that you submit to the IRS after preclearance. It's like a three-page letter. The next thing is you've got to prepare original and or amended income tax returns for all the years covered. So it'd be 2003 through 2010. You've got to prepare the original and or amended FBARs. You've got to prepare the disclosure forms. We mentioned one earlier, the 3520, but there's other disclosure forms for foreign entities and foreign partnerships. You've got to provide, now, if the aggregate balances are over $500,000, then you have to actually provide the bank statements to the Treasury. That's not a requirement if the aggregate balances are under $500,000, but you have to be prepared to provide them if requested. So, as a matter of course, that's one of the first things we request, is the bank statements. Now, this is not something that the IRS asked for, but I think it's something that should be provided as a glossary of foreign financial terms. When you receive these bank statements, often they're in French or German, and the recent case we had was in Danish. And I'm not fluent in Danish, and so it was one of those things where we had to get the client to provide a glossary for us to translate some of the key phrases, and that was very helpful. And in a lot of these requirements, we found that working cooperatively with the client is very helpful. It's a lot less expensive for the client to request bank statements, for example, than it is for us to request them. We'll do so if it's necessary, but you know, if there's an opportunity to save money, we'll ask the client, we'll provide you with a list of things we need and just get it for us, and it'll move a lot more smoothly. We also need a description of how the highest aggregate account balance subject to the miscellaneous penalty was calculated. This is probably the most difficult part of the entire process. You've really got to figure out what is the highest aggregate account balance. Is there any amount of that highest aggregate account balance that is attributable to transfers between different accounts? And if there is, you've got to subtract those transfers out. It can be very, very complicated. And so, you know, again, we have to create a spreadsheet. You can work with the CPA or prepare these on your own. This is also not a requirement, but when the amended returns and the FBARs are submitted, I think it's helpful to provide a letter to the IRS that explains the context of the failure to disclose in the first place. Why did the client not file these FBARs? Why didn't he file the tax returns? Why didn't he report the income? That kind of information is useful to the IRS, and I think it helps to contextualize all of the forms that you're filing when you're ready to do so. The other thing is, the other requirement is that you've got to pay or arrange to pay for the ultimate tax liability by August 31st. And my understanding of that is that you don't have to get everything paid off, but if you enter into an installment agreement, that is something that should be done well before the August 31st deadline. So it's a steep order of a lot of different requirements that have to be done before August 31st. Okay, what are the consequences for exclusion? Let's say a client comes to you after the August 31st deadline. What do you do? Well, the IRS says that if you miss the deadline, then you're going to be subject to additional penalties, and they're not going to limit it to 2003, meaning the 2003 to 2010 window, which is the window for the OBDI program. The IRS reserves the right to go back to years prior to 2003 and look for unreported income, failure to file FBARs, the penalties for a willful failure to file an FBAR, very steep. It's the greatest of $100,000 or half the balance in the account, Tim? Tim, is that what it, the penalty for failure to file the FBAR willful failure?
$100,000 or 50% of the account.
Or 50% of the account balance. So
per year.
Right.
It can be 300% over 6 years.
Right. So these are the consequences you're facing for missing this deadline. This is just really a rhetorical question. Does the IRS have an incentive to make it difficult to comply with the August 31st deadline? I would say it does. I think the IRS does have an incentive to make it difficult to comply. And why they're trying to get as many people in the door, I think, as possible before August 31st. And as Morris mentioned earlier, the IRS says that taxpayers have had plenty of time to comply. This is really not their first opportunity to come forward. So if they don't if the taxpayers don't come forward by August 31st, it is possible that there could be higher collection potential and, you know, perhaps less institutional humiliation, as Morris was talking about earlier. You have fewer participants in the program, and then they basically will be able to collect more, possibly, you know, through ordinary civil audits. Okay, so what's the first challenge for participation in the program? Is obtaining foreign bank account statements. This is seems like a straightforward thing, but it's not. It can be very complicated. Every bank's different in terms of what kind of information they need to, you know, to distribute client-sensitive information. If you represent an estate, and you have to be prepared to provide, you know, certified copies of all the probate documents. That's something we've had to do several times. The, as I said, the statements have to be submitted if the accounts are over $500,000, and you also have to be prepared to translate these statements. It's also a very difficult process unless you have, you know, some help from a client. UBS was kind enough to provide French and German glossaries of the relevant financial terms on its website, so that was helpful. All right, the second challenge in the OBDI program is accounting for transactions in foreign currency. And I'm not going to go into this in any detail because Norman LeBlanc covered this already, but there's all kinds of gain and loss calculations that have to be made, PFIC issues, conversions from U.S. to, or from foreign currencies to U.S. dollars get very complicated. Accounting for fund transfers. It's not enough just to sort of mechanically gather the account statements, create a spreadsheet, and just determine the highest balance just the basis of the numbers on the account statements. You have to make sure that no amount of the highest aggregate balances includes transfers between accounts, because if it does, you have to bring that to the attention of the Treasury and basically remove it from the OVD, from the penalty calculation, remove it from the amount subject to the miscellaneous penalty. Okay. All right. What if the taxpayer is dissatisfied with the penalties proposed under the OBDI? What options does he or she have? Well, you can decide to, it's called opt out. And it's important to note that opting out of the program really just means that you're opting out of the penalty calculation portion. If you just don't agree with the penalty that's proposed, you can decide to opt out of the penalty piece. You're still technically within the OVDI program, which means that the IRS will not recommend criminal prosecution if you, you know, comply with all your requirements to be forthright and to cooperate with the government. So you have a little bit of comfort there that there's most likely not going to be a criminal investigation initiated if you do decide to opt out. If you do opt out, the IRS is should consider a reasonable cause and, you know, lack of willfulness in calculating penalties. And that discretion is not available under the OBDI program. And so if you're opting out of the penalty piece and there's a lot of mitigating circumstances or room for reasonable cause, that might be a wise choice. And then, of course, if there's no agreement after opting out, and the examiner proposes some amount that's still not acceptable to the taxpayer has got the right to appeal or file a petition with the U.S. Tax Court. Well, dangers for people who don't come forward, it's going to leave the taxpayer possibly vulnerable to criminal prosecution. And I'm going to ask Jonathan at the end of this panel to share his thoughts on that. You know, criminal conviction. Well, obviously, there's major consequences for criminal conviction. If you're, you know, a professional, doctor, or lawyer, you could lose your license. As Ellen Keith talked about, there are immigration problems for people who hold H-1 or other temporary work visas. What are the opportunities that are available? Well, The first thing is just to come into compliance with tax obligations, to avoid what might be considered an imminent IRS crackdown, meaning they're cooperating, many foreign banks are already cooperating with the U.S. government in providing information about account holders in the United States or residents of the United States. So it might be a way to avoid what might be an imminent investigation. And another opportunity, the basic opportunity, I would say, is to get peace of mind that there's not going to be a criminal investigation initiated against your client if he or she complies with all the requirements of the program. Okay. Anyone have any questions about the general participation in the OBDI program? Yes.
For the folks with no unreported income or strictly signature authority, they still need to get their FRs in by August 31st to avoid some penalties.
June 30th is the deadline for FBARs on an annual basis.
But if you have from prior years unreported,
We'll explain the situation. Is there unreported income for those years?
Unreported income.
But just signature authority?
Signature authority or just non-disclosure.
Okay, then I would prepare those FBARs for the years that weren't filed. And attach a rider to the FBARs and explain, you know, why the FBARs weren't filed to begin with.
But weren't they in the frequently asked questions that they should get it in by August 31st?
Yes. The answer is you should get it in. You should also explain with the filing. I put it in the rider and I put it in the transmittal letter. Belt and suspenders helps here. That it's being filed because you have signature authority, but that you do not have any income tax obligation connected with that prior filing. I think the frequently asked question also suggests that our mandates that you file a tax return. And I'm not sure how it would work if you have signature authority, but my guess would be that you would file a personal tax return, you would file a copy of your personal tax return showing that all taxes are paid up to date, and that you're simply filing because you have a signature authority. That's how I would do it.
Yes.
If you have, you've accepted in the program, you've come to terms with what the penalty is going to be, you paid your tax, What kind of closure are you getting from the IRS? Meaning, audit.
It's a good question because we haven't gotten any closure yet. We have so many cases that we're working on, but we haven't actually gotten to the end point. You know, for the 2011 OBDI, we have one client for which we're very close, but I would imagine the end point would just be some sort of final closure letter from the IRS, and then ultimately a bill. You know, you settle upon the liability, and then you receive, you know, the client would receive a bill for the, you know, but it all has to be agreed to.
Right, but does it mean that the IRS isn't coming in 2003 to 2010 or whatever years and being able to open up those returns for, you know, deeper audit? You know, it's a certification.
The idea, my understanding of the OBDI is it's really supposed to be a verification audit, meaning they're not going through a full-blown, you know, investigation into every line in the tax return. Yes, Morris?
That's correct. And as a result, since it's only a verification, and they say it's a verification, they say that it is not an audit, what means is that the IRS explicitly retains the right to audit again. Now, normally at the conclusion of an audit, the IRS no longer has the right to audit again because this would be considered oppressive conduct by the government against the citizen to re-audit something that has already been audited. But the government explicitly keeps the right to continue to audit, and that, as you said,
Yes.
What about when you file the FBAR from, let's say, 2003 forward, are you opening up the 2003 tax return again? The FBAR filing?
It depends how much underreporting there was. I think if you're underreported 25% of your income or more.
I understand that, but yes. I'm just.
In a situation where there's.
That's a 6 year.
Yeah. In a situation where there's there hasn't been income reported in those years, or
no,
just the filing requirement.
Just to file the FBAR. I don't know if there's income or not, but just to file the FBAR, does that open up in 2003? Does that open up the 2003 return again? But just filing the FBAR.
It's unclear. I don't know. It's a good question.
You have to wait to find out if there's an income issue before you're going to know that.
Yes, sir.
Isn't the FBAR report separate because it's under Title 31 versus
right.
Title 26? So I'm not sure that opens. I have two questions. One is the penalty for the grade of 100,000 or 50%, did that kick in after October 2003 or 4, so it only applied to those tax years?
Yeah.
There's a different non-local type penalty, a local penalty before that. And my second item, just to follow up on Morris, under the 2009 program, I recall signing off on 906s when they concluded the audit. Are you saying that they're not going to provide those 906s?
Well, like I said, I don't know. We haven't concluded yet, so we're still, yeah.
I'm not sure that anybody's going to pick up a case until after August 31. My
right.
understanding is the agency still dealing with the pre-2011 cases.
That makes sense.
But to open up a taxpayer after they go through this program with the certification to say that the 2003 to 2011 just to follow up on something, Mars is more than impressive.
Yeah, it doesn't sound fair at all.
Well, and I think going down those lines, and Matthew knows I'm going to challenge him a bit on this, I don't find the OVDI program, especially the 2011 one, particularly attractive for most people unless they're really entering the program to avoid criminal prosecution. If you're dealing with pension accounts, if you're dealing with other things, OVDI is... In my opinion, you know, again, really good for someone who's been hiding income, hiding accounts overseas, but you have the majority of the people out there are people who are making more innocent mistakes of coming from overseas, having a pension account, having a small bank account. And I think for someone who owes a few hundred or a few thousand in extra taxes and didn't file, to give away 25% or more of their account automatically. And I think one of the challenges you have as advisors is to say, you know, depending, are you a defense attorney, are you a tax attorney, are you a CPA, you might have a different slant as to what you think is best for the potential client or for yourself. But make no mistake, OVDI is not, it doesn't give the peace of mind that I think Matthew is saying in terms of, I personally feel it opens you up. Even the pre-clearance letter puts you on the radar screen. You might not have been on the radar screen before, but if you go in and ask for pre-clearance and you weren't there, I don't think they're going to ignore your name.
And what if so, they're going to come? What if they're going to? Your name's going to be turned over anyway.
Okay. So, but the thing is, if you look at the number of people whose names are going to be turned over by UBS or HSBC versus the entire population of people who have these problems, I think it's pretty small. So I think, you know,
you're
OVDI
right.
or non-OVDI, it's definitely a case-by-case. There's no set rules, and I think you have to be real careful because, I don't know, I think for a lot of people, silent disclosure with having Bill's number in the back just in case may be the better alternative.
I agree with you. I just think it's a risk, and you have to inform your clients of the risk and, you know, let them make the call. Yes, Morris.
Just a comment also that I agree with Jonathan that it has to be done on a case-by-case basis. But having said that, beginning in 2013, most people who have significant offshore assets are going to find that the IRS knows about it. And so the question becomes, how is it best for these taxpayers? Is it best for the IRS to find out through the FATCA program, or is it best for these people to come forward now? And if they find that the penalties are too onerous, perhaps opt out and find themselves in a regular voluntary program where they are permitted to contest the penalties and where they can argue about mitigation and lack of willfulness and reasonable cause and that stuff.
Okay, so I don't think the last word has been written on FATCA. There's a lot of resistance from foreign banking associations. There's a lot of government saying, well, listen, if you want us to give you this information, you have to give us the same. Well, back in March of this year, every congressperson from the state of Florida wrote a letter and signed it to President Obama that basically said, no, we will not agree to the IRS being able to disclose non-US citizens' accounts in the United States. There's an estimated $3 trillion or more of foreign deposits in the U.S., and the U.S. plays in an international environment, so foreign governments are not going to accept that they're going to transmit all kinds of information to the United States without the United States sending information the other way. So while I agree with you, the risk is there. FATCA is a disaster. Already the results are Americans and overseas are being forced into special units of banks overseas. You can't walk into a lot of countries' banks and say, I'm a U.S. citizen, and open even a regular bank account. And so the U.S. people are actually being shut out of the international banking system for banks who really don't want to bear the cost of FATCA. So I agree. FATCA was about one of the worst pieces of legislation ever written. The intentions were good, but in practical speaking, most banks really have little intention to comply. Japan, for example, Japan essentially threatened to pull out $300 billion of investments in the U.S. for the less than 0.04% of their domestic accounts that have anything to do with the U.S. Australia's the same, Brazil's the same. They've all been fighting this. So watch this space. I don't think the final word's been written.
Great. Now we're going to talk about the much-awaited penalty structure of the 2011 OVDI. I hope it's everything you've always hoped for. But before I talk about this, I'd like to ask if anyone has the little slip, the questions that you can bring to the panel four roundtable. Either write them up now or bring them up or whatever. I'd like to have a few minutes before I'm moderating that section. So if I could just give a few minutes to read beforehand, I'd appreciate it. Okay. So we've talked a little bit, each panelist sort of hinted on the penalties. And the first thing that you have to realize is that the normal, actually, let me start again. We talked about the 2009 penalties, we've talked about the 2011 penalties, and we're also gonna talk about the statutory penalties. And I want you to keep all three in mind because it's sort of a fluid situation because, for one, a person who came forward in 2009 is not gonna be hit with a more onerous penalty than would be applied if he came into the 2011 program. For instance, the 12.5% penalty I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. The second thing is that under no circumstances is a person in the OVDI, according to the facts, going to be hit with a harder penalty than is statutorily applicable. So I want you to keep all three things in mind, and we're going to talk about them right now. So the first thing you have to do is you have to pay taxes, you have to pay interest. Failure to file, 25% applies, may apply. Failure to pay may also apply, and then you have the 20% accuracy-related penalty, and that is standard. That always applies, especially in the FBAR context. Then we have the miscellaneous offshore penalty. In 2009, it was 20%. In 2011, it's 25%, and that's based on the highest aggregate account balance during the OVDI period, which was 2003 to 2010. And as I just mentioned, there's a couple mitigation thresholds here. The 25% penalty can be reduced either to 12.5% or to 5% depending upon the taxpayer's circumstances. The first one is the reduction to 12.5%. That occurs if the person has less than $75,000 in the account during the OVDI period, which again, 2003 to 2010. There's a reduction from 25% to 5% for someone in the 2011 OVDI. If one, they didn't open the account or cause the account to be open, they had minimal infrequent contact with the account, they maybe changed an account holder, they maybe request an account statement. Number three, except for the final withdrawal, they did not withdraw more than $1,000 from the account in any year. And number four, they paid all the taxes on the amount deposited in the account. So it could earn income while it's in there as long as the money that was initially put into the account, was taxes were paid on it. There's also a reduction from 25% to 5% in the case that you have a foreign resident who was unaware that they were a U.S. citizen. So, for example, this is actually quoted from the facts. The taxpayer was born in the U.S. to parents of foreign citizenship. She grew up in the foreign jurisdiction. She never knew that she was born in the U.S. And she had, she's in the foreign country. She has a $60,000 account in a foreign jurisdiction, never filed a U.S. return, never filed an FBAR. And then she finally became aware that she was a U.S. citizen simply for the fact that she was born for whatever period that her parents were on holiday in the U.S. She owes $3,000 to the United States Treasury. She never stepped foot in the United States aside from being born when she was a baby. And she owes the U.S. government $3,000. I think that's a little ridiculous, but that's the way it is. This is the 2009 reduction to 5%. And actually, 2011 is a little bit more lenient because we talked about the first one's essentially the same. They didn't cause it to open or didn't open it. In 2009, you can only get the 5% reduction if there was absolutely no activity. Whereas we just talked about in 2011, there could be minimal, a little bit of activity. You know, nothing major like, depositing money, but if you request a balance or if you do request less than $1,000, you could still be eligible in 2011. And finally, one on the bottom is the same as in the other one. All taxes have been paid on that account. So now we have the penalty base, and there's a substantial difference between 2009 and 2011 with the penalty base. In 2009, you were talking about the highest aggregate balance in a foreign financial account during the OVDI or the OVDP period. Now, the IRS wants to include in the base any assets that are in any way related to tax noncompliance. So, any asset that generates income or was purchased with unreported income now is included. So if you bought a house with money that was not reported to the US Treasury, now that's included in the penalty base. And it's the fair market value of the real estate. So if you bought this in 2005 at the height of the real estate, well, that's probably a bad example. But if any appreciation is now included in the base, despite the fact that a smaller sum of money was actually unreported to the US Treasury.
Tim, it's not a bad example because the dollar has gone down more than 30% against most currencies. So if it's overseas, you might still be sitting in a dollar gain.
Okay. So again, it's and we actually have a question from the audience, which I'm looking forward to talking about, in which you do have to include the value of the real estate in the penalty base, the 25% penalty base. Now we have the no duplication rule. In 2009, the 20% offshore penalty was applied to the highest aggregate balance in each account. Now, in the example where you have account number one, which had $100,000 at the beginning of the year, and account number two that had zero balance at the beginning of the year, if you put all of one into two during the year, you're going to get hit for both accounts for the 20% penalty. Now, it's the taxpayer's job, it's their burden to show that there actually was a transfer from one account to the other or from one banking institution to another banking institution. So, you know, it's still a tough penalty, but if you can show that the money was transferred, it was not new money, then it will not be included in the penalty base. All right, now we're going to talk about the statutory FBAR penalties. In terms of individuals, there's penalties based on willful and non-willful violations, and it's for each account, for each year, for each holder of the account, or for each person who has signature authority of the account. In the definition of willful, we briefly talked about, it's the voluntary and intentional violation of a known legal duty. So the government has to show by clear and convincing evidence that you it was substantially more likely than not that you knew you had an FBAR filing obligation, but you consciously chose not to. And here's the gentleman briefly spoke. The demarcation line was October 23, 2004. There were no penalty violations for not no penalties for non-willful FBAR violations before that date. After that date, the maximum the IRS can impose is $10,000 for each violation. And for non-willful violations, at least, there's no penalty that will be imposed if the taxpayer can show that the violation was due to reasonable cause and the amount was actually reported through an FBAR. So you have to first argue a reasonable, first submit the FBAR and then argue that reasonable cause has been met. And reasonable cause is defined in the Internal Revenue Manual as the taxpayer exercised ordinary business care and prudence in determining a tax obligation, but nevertheless failed to comply. Now we're going to talk about willful FBAR violations. Again, before October 23, 2004, the penalty for willful FBAR violation was $25,000 or the amount in the account not to exceed $100,000. The maximum penalty after that date is definitely more steep, and that's $100,000 or 50% in the account at the time of the violation. And there's no reasonable cause exception for willful FBAR violations. So we talked about those are the maximum penalties under the statutory regime. Now we're going to talk about penalty mitigation, and later we're going to talk about how to abate the taxes or the penalties completely. So you have to meet four threshold conditions in order to be able to be eligible for penalty mitigation. The first one is that the taxpayer had no history of past FBAR penalty assessments. Number two, there's no money in the foreign account that was from an illegal source or used to further a criminal purpose. Three, taxpayer cooperated. And no civil fraud penalties were sustained in the year in question. I'm not going to talk about each and every one because this is going to be a little bit tedious after a while, but just to begin, if you have a non-willful violation and the amount in the account is less than or equal to $50,000, there's a $500 penalty. We actually had a client recently who he had about $11,000 in a foreign account in the UK, and he obviously, since it's greater than $10,000, he had to file an FBAR. He never did. It generated about literally $4 each year, so he just didn't know. And in this case, there would be a good, it would be a good advice for him, for one, not to opt out of the OBDI because he doesn't want to get hit for 25%, or to just, and he'll be hit with $500 instead for each year. The level three is, again, the statutory maximum $1,000. Penalty mitigation for willful FBAR violations. Before October 23rd, 2004, it was the greater of $25,000 or the amount in the account not to exceed $100,000. After, it's the great, the maximum is the, I'm sorry, before is less than or equal to 20, it's 5% of the max balance, or if it's greater than $1 million, you have $100,000 or the amount in the account in the last day of filing, which is down here in level four. After October 23, 2004, if it's less than or equal to $50,000, the penalty will be the greater of $1,000 or 5% of the max balance in the account. And if it's greater than $1 million, essentially you get no penalty mitigation because you're back to $100,000 or 50% in the account. What's intriguing about opting out of the program, and you know, I know the default baseline for the IRS is probably give them $10,000 maximum non-willful penalty. However, the actual discretion, in theory, is left up to the examiner to determine what penalty is applicable. And overall, in determining the penalty that's applicable, the IRS wants to show or wants to be, you know, wants to establish that there's going to be future compliance with the taxpayer's FBAR violations. And finally, I'll note here that, and I've emphasized that the maximum penalty, since they are so severe, should only be considered in the most egregious cases, and that's cited in the Internal Revenue Manual. So I know in theory there's the assumption that it's the max penalty that will automatically apply. However, when you're out of the OBDI regime, the actual penalty is essentially left up to the discretion of the examiner. Other discretion, or examiner discretion, more things to consider, whether compliance will be achieved with a warning letter, whether they've been previously issued a warning letter, the nature and the amounts involved, and the cooperation of the taxpayer during the examination. As noted before, with the if you have more than $1 million in a non-willful or a willful context, you're essentially going to be hit no matter what with the maximum penalty. Yes, Morris.
If the Internal Revenue Manual says that the examiner is supposed to exercise discretion, suppose the examiner doesn't exercise discretion in the way that you would like. Do you know if there's an appeal to the courts?
Outside of the program, yes. Within the OVDI program, there's no appeal or anything, but outside, if you're within the statutory regime, you can appeal, yes. Additional related penalties. Again, I mentioned there's the failure to file, the failure to pay, the accuracy, and these are all, I mentioned them before in the OVDI. Now we're talking about them under the statutory regime. So we have accuracy related, failure to file the 3520, which is the receipt of foreign gifts or receipt from a foreign trust. And then there's also the civil fraud penalty. But if you're going to be dealing with a civil fraud penalty, or even if there's a whiff you're going to be dealing with a civil fraud penalty, go back to the OBDI. I'm going to skip over criminal. I'm just going to say, talk to Bill Lovett. We can get you his number. And as I mentioned before, the reason why I wanted you to keep in mind the three, the statutory regime, the 2009 regime, and the 2011 regime, is because even if someone's in the 2009, they could be hit with a 2011 penalty, or they may decide to opt out because the 2011 penalty, you know, you can show non-willfulness. So again, under the Fact 50, under no circumstances will taxpayers be required to pay a penalty greater than that what they'll be liable for under the maximum penalties under existing statutes. So I read that as saying if you're going to be subject to a less penalty within the statutory regime, the non-willful statutory regime, presumably, it's best to opt out. Or not opt out, that will be the penalty. And then I would question under what circumstances would a person opt out of the 2011 program, and Jonathan's briefly touched on this, and I think that the only reason why you would is if you're facing criminal exposure, in which case you may not, there's no guarantee you won't be prosecuted, but the IRS will generally not recommend criminal prosecution. Any questions? Great. Now, Jonathan Lashewitz will...
I don't have a particular presentation.
Okay.
I think we were going to just discuss some stuff on the
Okay. Do you want to get the roundtable together then?
I think we can do that if there's no other questions at this point.
Okay. That's fine. So the if anyone has any questions, I've gotten three of them. We have room for more.
Do you want to take those questions now?
Yeah.